Blog Talk Radio.
I might not be able to hear it through this.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Richard Cabeza coming to you from WBFT in Portland, Maine. After countless years of research, billions of dollars spent, I am here to confirm that we still do not know where the fuck Bigfoot is.
It was like at least, I would say, in between 8 to 10 feet tall. Because it was brown, hairy. And I don't get freaked out by woods, dark, nothing, and that freaks me out. So.
All right, you're listening to Bigfoot Ground Zero, episode number 5. My name is Dave, and in tonight's program, we're going to talk to a gentleman who has had a sighting, actually two different sightings, a few years apart in the great state of Oregon. And then what we're going to do is we are going to follow up with an interview with Carl, who, if you are new to the program, Carl is actually the research and brains behind the operation here. I'm just the guy who talks. We're going to talk about some Bigfoot hotspots in Northern Virginia and the overlap of some missing hikers and disappearance cases that the dates are pretty interesting. You can kind of draw your own conclusion, but it seems like the Bigfoot community out there is starting to recognize that maybe these things are not as gentle and fuzzy as some of the flute players would have you believe. Before we get into all of that, I want to talk about a news story that I was watching just a little while ago that broke on Fox News. Now, Fox News will pick up these stories every now and then because they know Bigfoot is big ratings. There's like an insatiable appetite for the public to want to know, does Sasquatch exist? Well, there's a lady who is a doctor whose name I will not say on my program, who is claiming to have Bigfoot DNA in her possession that once and for all proves the existence of Sasquatch. Now, okay, I get it. You know, some of these doctors are, you know, field biologists or whoever are trying to prove the existence of these creatures. I understand it. If you think you have evidence, bring it forward. But vet it out and get, you know, some of your peers to weigh in on the topic and your findings. But what you don't do is you don't put in front of me an absolutely clearly hoaxed picture of a Bigfoot. Not acceptable. I mean, I look at this screen and I want to tell this lady to go cloak herself. I get a little frustrated, and I actually was not joking. I just, it's frustrating because the rest of the world looks at us like we're lunatics, and it's because of things like this. You know, and the rest of us are out there researching, having honest discourse about the science behind it, the probability of these things existing, all these people coming forward, and we have anecdotal evidence. There's some scientific evidence to go with it, but this doesn't help us at all. Anyway, I'm going to settle down. I digress. We're going to talk to Todd Neese tonight. Todd and I actually had a conversation last week. We found each other through Facebook. And as you know, I vet all these stories because I want to make sure that I'm bringing you information that is as close to the real deal as I can find. Are people going to be able to get through sometimes? I'm sure there will be. But Todd is very forthright. He's a career military guy, Army National Guard. He's been overseas in the Middle East. He has actually seen combat. He works with high explosives on a regular basis. The guy doesn't get rattled very easily, but he's going to tell you a couple of incidents with Sasquatch. One was a sighting. One is what I'm going to call a near miss, where he was practically scared out of his skin, and he'll tell you that story. But listen to Todd, and I think you'll get an understanding of not only the kind of guy he is, but his character. And he is on top of it. He has been researching for 21 years since the first sighting that he had. And it was a long time, the sighting. I'll let him tell you how long it was, but you're going to be amazed. Then you won't be surprised at the detail he brings to the table on this. So anyway, I'm going to stop talking. We'll get into the interview with Todd, and I'll go ahead and follow up with some points of interest after that, just some of my notes from the interview. And then we will go ahead and speak with Carl. So without any further delay, let's talk to Todd.
All right, Todd, thanks for joining me tonight. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Now, I had prepped the listeners a little bit about some of your background, but I want them to hear it directly from you. You know, your military background, kind of what I thought were some of the unique things that make you qualified other than the sighting to kind of give some validity to what you saw. If you can just kind of jump in, give us a quick history of you, what you're doing now as far as your military career, and just leading up to the sighting, and we'll go from there.
Sounds good, David. My name's Todd Neese. You already know that part. I've been interested in Bigfoot research going on 21 years or so now. A topic that, frankly, I was not really interested in prior to 1993, and we'll get to that in a bit. But just by way of introduction, I've been born and raised in the Pacific Northwest, specifically Oregon, for the most part. And being from the Northwest, you can't help but hear of the legend of Bigfoot, and it's pretty pervasive, really. It's ensconced in the culture of this area for obvious reasons.
Sure.
But to me, it was something that I pretty much relegated to folklore, Indian lore, if you would, or just campfire tales, you know. Nothing really didn't put any stock into it. That changed in 1993, like I said, during a military exercise, and we'll get into that. But just, again, by way of introduction, I am currently a staff sergeant in the Oregon Army National Guard. I work full-time, active duty, put the uniform and boots on every day. In that capacity, I've worn a lot of hats. I'm currently an analyst for the Oregon Military Department, and I've worked in combat arms as a combat engineer. I've been deployed to combat in Iraq. You know, it's kind of been ingrained in my family, really. I mean, my father served in the Army, and I'm proud to say that all three of my sons have served their country in both the Marines and Navy. So let's fair enough say it's in my blood, but...
Sure. No, I appreciate that.
So where would you like to start, David?
Well, I guess what I'd like to know is, and I'm sure that listeners would like to know as well, is, you know, kind of what you were doing leading up to the sighting. I know you have demolitions training. I know you're doing some work during that, and I think you mentioned that you were riding in a Humvee when the sighting happened. And just for you folks who are listening, Todd and I had spoken ahead of time. I just kind of wanted to make sure I understood the full scope of the sighting so that I can bring the story to you more clearly. But, Todd, just, yeah, get into that day, you know, what it is you were doing. And I think the reason I ask this question is I think people need to understand that when a sighting occurs, it's not like something that you know is going to happen. So you're going about your day, you're doing your thing, and then all of a sudden, bam, your life has changed in a way that you can't imagine, and here you go. So do you mind just starting out the day and walking us through what you were doing and just go up through the sighting and go from there?
Sure. Being a combat engineer, part of what we do is demolition. Our mission is mobility and counter-mobility. So we literally use our skills to direct the movement elements, both friendly and enemy, through the use of explosives, some heavy equipment. We work with mines. But demolitions is a big part of it. And so on this particular day in 1993, the company I was with, we would go out into private timberland once a year to practice large quantity explosions, explosives that were of the quantity that had we used them on the base, we would more than likely shattered all the windows there. So
sure.
We're talking, you know, hundreds of pounds of ammonium nitrate, for instance, or plastic explosives, C4, composition 4.
Sure.
So it was that day came around where we were going to go up in the woods and do our thing. And we, you know, it was pretty, you know, standard procedure. And in this particular case, we had three quarries that we were going to work. And the first one, we would practice cutting charges where we would blow steel I-beams in half, simulating, for instance, dropping a bridge.
Sure.
The second site, there was a mock minefield, if you will. These were anti-tank mines that did not actually contain explosives, but we still would use those for training, setting up a ring main, not to get too technical, but setting plastic explosives next to these mines and basically blowing a lane through that minefield so vehicles and personnel could get through.
And were you guys, can I ask a question real quick?
Sure.
Were you, now, when you were doing this training, it was, did you simulate, you know, stressful conditions, setting up the demolition around these mines and that sort of thing? Or was it more or less still just becoming familiar and just keeping the training as far as knowing what to do and that sort of thing?
Well, to answer your question, we didn't have what they call OP4, which is opposition forces. And,
sure.
And that is the kind of thing we would do, say, at annual training.
Okay.
Where we would have an enemy basically harassing us. But that being said, we did practice light and noise discipline, litter discipline, things that you want to make sure that, you know, we acted as if the enemy were out there. But, yeah, it was
sure.
Strictly business.
Okay. Well, yeah, and I was just curious how that went.
Yeah. So, trust me, dealing with that quantity of explosives has a stress built into it.
Sure. No, I understand.
Yeah. But anyway, the third and final site, we did cratering charges where we would simulate, for instance, blowing a road apart so it could not be used by enemy forces. So I'll kind of fast forward to the sighting itself.
Sure.
We had set the charges on that third and final blast, the cratering charges. As I recall, it was several hundred pounds of ammonium nitrate that we had been soaking in diesel fuel for several hours. And lit the fuses, and our SOP was that we would basically get in our vehicles. We had about 11 minutes to before the explosion took place. We would convoy down to a safety staging area where we were out of direct line of sight, and we would sit there until we heard the explosion, and then we would go back and check our work, make sure we did what we intended to. And it was while we were in transit down to that safety staging area that, well, my life changed. It was an unusually nice day weather-wise for April in the Coast Range. You generally would expect, you know, stormy weather, but it was beautiful blue skies. And I would guess it would be around 3 in the afternoon.
Okay.
But it was nice enough that I had the window unzipped on my door in the Humvee. I sat directly behind the driver, and I did what I normally do in that setting is, you know, being an avid hunter and having hunted that area specifically for several years, I'm just kind of glancing across the countryside looking for any sort of wildlife, any deer or elk. We rounded a corner, and keep in mind this is a fairly narrow logging road, winding gravel covered road. We round this corner, and the second blast site came into view. And as I look down to that blast site, I see these three distinct black figures standing out in the open in that gravel pit that we had just detonated charges at less than an hour before that. And what struck me was, whenever we do an exercise like this, we have what we call 100% integrity. Part of the SOP says that everybody is accounted for. Nobody is, everybody is within the same body, if you will.
Sure.
And so when I first saw these figures standing there, the first thing that sprung to my mind is, what are those people doing down there? You know, what the hell are they doing? They shouldn't be there.
Sure.
But I never even got to finish the thought. It was like, what are those? And the more I looked, and looking at it, what I was looking at were not human.
Okay.
Again, they were really jet black, and standing out in that quarry, which is kind of a light gray basalt, they really stood out. There was quite a bit of contrast there. I would say that if these things were standing with a backdrop of trees, I probably never would have saw them. But the fact that they were standing out in the open, it was just, you couldn't miss it.
Sure. Now, you said there were three of them, right? So how dark were they? Were they black, or were they kind of like a dark brownish black? Or can you remember that kind of detail?
I would say they were black, like that of maybe a black bear. I mean,
okay.
I don't recall seeing any sort of reddish or brownish color to them at all.
Okay.
They stood shoulder to shoulder in a line. Obviously observing us. They were facing us. The three of them were different sizes. The one in the middle stood a full head taller than the two that flanked it, left and right. I'm going to estimate the height was close to 9 feet.
Okay.
The two that flanked it, although they were shorter, easily approached 7 feet.
Okay.
But what really set them apart was the shape of their bodies, I guess. I mean, what made them distinct from humans were the physiology was just wrong. The arms went way down past the knees. And they didn't appear to be hunched over, you know, where that would naturally lower the arms. They looked to be standing straight up, but those arms went below their kneecaps. The legs, too, were just too long. I mean, everything was just disproportionate to the torso, if you will.
Wow.
The torso itself was amazing just because these things – they looked like bodybuilders. I mean, their chests were huge, and there was a very noticeable taper from the chest, you know, say from the armpit area down to their waist. I mean, they literally looked like bodybuilders, all of them.
Sure.
The head, as is described in most sightings, seemed to sit squarely on the shoulders. No visible neck. So I mean, they almost looked like they had shoulder pads on. You could have put a helmet on them and put them on the field. They were huge. But there's no way they were human at all.
Now let me ask you this question. Now, you had mentioned in one of our conversations, the conversation before, I believe you got a good 10 or 15 second look at these things, right? Because as you were coming around okay. And how far away were you from these? Was it 100 yards, 50 yards, 25?
Well, I'm going to say it was closer to 300 yards. Now,
okay.
I realize that sounds like a great distance to most people, but given the conditions, an unobstructed view, these things standing in this gravel pit,
yeah.
The contrast, and the fact that when I'm out at the rifle range, we shoot at 300 meters, actually.
Sure.
And ironically, those are the targets I hit. Somehow I missed the 200-meter targets, but... Anyway, you can distinctly make out a silhouetted target at 300 meters well enough to shoot it with open sight rifles. So, I mean, but anyway, I make no apologies for the distance. It is what it is. I tell people I was not close enough to make out facial features or gender, but I'll never forget the shape of the bodies, the size of the bodies. And one other thing I should add is the activity that they were engaged in other than watching us. As I mentioned that, I believe I did, the one that stood in the middle, the tallest one, stood there like a statue. It just did not budge at all.
Sure.
But the two shorter ones that flanked it,
yep.
were exhibiting this swaying motion, if you will. They rocked side to side. They were like shifting their weight from one foot to the other, and they were both doing it.
Was it like they were agitated kind of moving, or was it like just a gentle sway, like they were trying to focus on something like great apes can do?
It's hard to tell. I mean, it seemed very natural for them.
Sure.
I have, you know, since dealt with a lot of authorities, not just in Bigfoot per se, but in primatology, and that type of behavior, as you mentioned,
yeah.
is typical of primates that are excited or agitated, that are nervous. It's kind of a, I don't know, imagine being them, having their world rocked. Who knows how close they were when that explosion went off, but they obviously had to be in that area.
That was my, and I'm so glad that you brought that up, and I want to continue, but I want to get this out there because I will forget. My attention span is very short. I apologize.
Sure.
When the blast went off then, do you think, and I think this is where you're going, I want to make sure that I'm not putting words in your mouth, do you think that brought them down out of curiosity, or do you think it shook them out of where they were and they're agitated now and that's kind of how you saw them?
Well, probably a little of both. You know, what took place with that explosion certainly had to be a shock to them if they were anywhere in the vicinity.
Right.
And you mentioned the curiosity factor, which I think speaks a lot to their intelligence. You know, where most animals and most people would say, you know, you set off 200 pounds of C4, 300 throw up a mushroom cloud that went up a good 400 or 500 feet. Most animals are going to go 360 degrees away. From that. But I think what I would relate this to, if you will, is imagine you're sitting in your home.
Sure.
And you hear a plane flying very low, and three or four blocks away it eventually crashes to the ground in your neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
You feel the ground shake, you see a fireball, you see smoke. Now, initially, you're going to be shocked. You're going to go, "Oh my God, you know, what just happened?" And you're going to try to somehow come to terms with what just took place. But given 20 minutes, 30 minutes, even an hour, when you're sure that there's not going to be another plane following suit,
sure.
I think your curiosity is going to get the best of you. Maybe even, with people, that you're going to want to maybe even get there to see if there's anything you can do. But I think your curiosity would eventually overcome your shock and fear of what just took place, and you're going to want to go investigate it. And I don't think it's any different than with what happened with these animals. Is their neighborhood got shocked with something unnatural, but their curiosity got the best of them, and once they were sure that we had left that area, they got up the courage to come out and investigate.
Well, let me ask you this question then, because that's a great observation, and I think then let's take it maybe one step further, and I would think that would be in relation to where the explosion was set and detonated, and in relation to where you saw these creatures and where you were leaving, did it look like they were doing just that, heading in the direction where you had just vacated?
No, they were there.
They were? Okay, gotcha.
And they did not move other than that shifting activity that I mentioned during the course of time that I watched them.
Sure.
As we'll see here shortly, there was another witness I discovered shortly thereafter, and ultimately a total of four witnesses, myself included, eventually came forward describing pretty much the same thing, same number of animals, same description. Just getting back to something you had alluded to earlier about how much time I actually watched them.
Sure.
It was more along the lines, I would estimate, about 25 seconds.
Wow, that's a lot. Do you realize you really, really hit the jackpot? Most people out there listening are going, "That's insane." You know how many people would give a left arm to see that, right?
Oh, no doubt. I do consider myself very fortunate, and and part of my research is hopefully to have that experience again. It's a one in a million shot at but to have those circumstances with this particular encounter really set it apart from a lot of others. The fact that there were three creatures seen, the fact that the activity that we were engaged in at the time, and the fact that there were four eyewitnesses that came forward, all very serious, sober soldiers. So,
can I ask one quick question about the distance that you saw these creatures at? And again, I believe you 100%, so I'm coming at this more of we've already established that this has happened, but
yeah.
Can you estimate the height of these things, even with that distance of almost 300 yards? I mean, if you're looking at it now in your mind's eye saying, geez, they easily could have been 8 or 9 feet tall, they were that big from far away, or how would you estimate?
Well, because there were points of reference at the site itself. For instance, there was a... the quarry itself was had two tiers to it, if you will.